I was asked to talk about emptiness, especially within the context of the three principal aspects of the path. So I thought it would be nice for those who had copies if we read that text out loud together to give you the preview. I bow down to the venerable spiritual masters. I will explain as well as I am able the essence of all the teachings of the conquered, the path praised by the conquerors and their spiritual children, the entrance for the fortunate ones who desire liberation. Listen with clear minds, you fortunate ones who direct your mind to the path pleasing to the Buddha, and strive to make good use of leisure and opportunity without being attached to the joys of cyclic existence. For you embodied beings bound by the craving for existence, without pure determination to be free from the ocean of existence, there is no way for you to pacify the attractions to its pleasurable effects. Thus, from the outset, seek to generate the determination to be free. By contemplating the leisure and endowment so difficult to find, and the fleeting nature of your life, reverse the clinging to this life. By repeatedly contemplating the infallible effects of karma and the miseries of cyclic existence, reverse the clinging to future lives. By contemplating in this way, do not generate even for an instant the wish for the pleasures of cyclic existence. When you have day and night unceasingly the mind aspiring for liberation, then you have generated the determination to be free. However, if your determination to be free is not sustained by the pure altruistic intention, it does not become the cause for the perfect bliss of unsurpassed enlightenment. Therefore, the intelligent generate the supreme thought of enlightenment. Swept by the current of the four powerful rivers, guided by the strong bonds of karma which are so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping egoism, completely enveloped by the darkness of ignorance, born and reborn in boundless cyclic existence, unceasingly tormented by the three miseries, by thinking of all mother sentient beings in this condition, generate the supreme altruistic aspiration. Even if you meditate upon the determination to be free and the altruistic intention, without the wisdom realizing the final nature, you cannot cut the root of cyclic existence. Therefore, strive for the means to realize dependent arising. One who sees the infallible cause and effect of all phenomena in cyclic existence and beyond, and destroys all false perceptions, has entered the path which pleases the Buddha. Appearances are infallible dependent arisings. Emptiness is free of assertions. As long as these two understandings are seen as separate, one has not yet realized the intent of the Buddha. When these two realizations are simultaneous and concurrent, from the mere sight of infallible dependent arising comes to different knowledge which completely destroys all modes of mental grasping. At that time, the analysis of the profound view is complete. In addition, appearances clear away the extreme of existence. Emptiness clears away the extreme of non-existence. When you understand the arising of cause and effect from the viewpoint of emptiness, you are not captivated by either of the extreme views. In this way, when you have realized the exact points of the three principal aspects of the path, by depending on solitude, generate the power of joyous effort, and quickly accomplish the final goal, my child. I really love this text. It's quite powerful. And you could actually, you know, explain it for years and years and years and years. Okay, so just as a review, the three principal aspects of the path are first the determination to be free, also called renunciation. Second, the altruistic intention, also called in Sanskrit bodhicitta. And third, the wisdom realizing emptiness, also called the correct view. Okay, so of all the Buddhist teachings, if we were to synthesize them all into the three most important things to understand, those are the three. Okay, so if you don't remember anything else, remember those three. Okay, if you have to take out a little post-it, you know, or scribble it on the back of, you know, your gas receipt or your, you know, your grocery bill, remember those three. Okay, so the determination to be free is the mind that sees the disadvantages of remaining in cyclic existence, living our life on automatic, letting our mind go here and there under the influence of ignorance, anger, and attachment, following whatever impulse pops into our mind. So we're seeing the disadvantages of that and of its results, all the confusion and the difficulties that we go through in life. And as a result of understanding that, developing the determination to be free from it. So in Buddhism, this is what is meant by compassion for ourselves. Okay, think about that a little bit. Yeah, renunciation, determining to be free, is having compassion for ourselves. We think having compassion for ourselves is going out and buying a new sweater. You know, our compassion for ourselves is going on holiday. Okay, compassion for ourselves is renouncing, you know, unsatisfactory conditions and their causes, and aspiring for true liberation. Okay. So that's the first thing we have to do. Without that kind of mind, we really, you know, it's very difficult to practice because our mind's completely caught in all of our worldly concerns. After we develop that, then we start looking around and we see, you know, everybody else is in the same boat. Yeah, I mean, we always think we're special. Either we're better than everybody else or worse than everybody else. Somehow we're special. But, you know, when we really look around, you know, we're all kind of packaged differently. Our bodies look different, you know, and we might, you know, have different political views and things like this. Boy, do we. You know, we're all the same in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. Now, and anybody you look at from any walk of life in any country of whatever socioeconomic class or whatever educational group, everybody's exactly the same. And if you look, you know, whether you like somebody or you don't like somebody, or, you know, you want to be with them or they terrify you, whatever it is, they all want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. Everybody's exactly the same. Okay? So whether you're Osama bin Laden or George Bush, you're really basically the same. Those two are the same in more than one way. excuse me, I can't resist. But they are the same in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, aren't they? You know, whether we agree with them or don't agree with them. You know, they both want happiness and they both want to be free of suffering. So it's that way with all living beings. So, you know, if we can open our mind to that fact, we start really tearing down walls and feeling connected to others. We start seeing them as kind because we see how our whole life and everything we have, everything we know is dependent on them. And then from there, the wish comes to repay that kindness. And you can only give away, you know, you can only give away so many boxes of chocolate to repay people's kindness before they start getting cavities and complain. So you have to think of another way to repay their kindness. Yeah, besides taking them out to movies and giving them boxes of chocolate. You know, which ultimately, you know, you take them out to movies that waste their time and give them a box of chocolate and they have to pay for dental bills. So, you know, is that really repaying people's kindness? You know, what does it mean to repay others' kindness? So from a Buddhist view, you know, what this means is to be able to influence people so they stop creating the cause of suffering and start creating the cause of happiness. Okay. But in order to influence people in a positive way so that they grow on the path to enlightenment, we have to actualize the path in our own mind. And so that's what the bodhicitta, or the altruistic intention is that wish to become fully enlightened so that we can be of the greatest benefit to everybody. Okay, so that's the second principal aspect of the path. And that one, they say, is if you churn milk, you get butter, right? The butter is kind of what, like the essence of, you know, it's the good stuff out of the milk. So bodhicitta is like the cream, that's the word, the cream, if you churn all the Buddhist teachings, that altruistic intention. Okay? Then, if we want to become enlightened, you know, we can't just sit there and, you know, pray, may I become enlightened. And, we have to, again, create the causes, and we have to eliminate the root of our suffering, which is ignorance. And so for that, we need the correct view of the nature of reality. So that's the third principal aspect of the path, and that's the one that I'm going to be talking about this evening. Okay, so we're going to be doing the third one, and that starts with the verse, okay, that says, even if you meditate upon the determination to be free and the altruistic intention, without the wisdom realizing the final nature, how things actually exist, you cannot cut the root of cyclic existence. Therefore, strive for the means to realize dependent arising. So when we're talking about this third principal aspect of the path, you know, the correct view, there's several different outlines under it. The first one is why you need to meditate on the correct view, and that's what this verse explains, is why we need to meditate on the correct view. The second point, which the next verse goes into, is what is the correct view. The verse after that goes into how to know when the analysis you're doing and the view you have is still incomplete. And then the verse after that is how to know when the analysis you're doing and the view that you've developed is complete. And then the fifth outline is the unique teaching of the Prasangika Majjhimika school. Okay, and that has a verse by itself. So we'll go through these one at a time. And if you don't understand everything, don't worry about it, because I don't either. Mm-hmm. So you might wonder why I'm teaching it, and that's because I'm a big fake. So I will just do my best and explain it to you, and I really pray that you hear it from teachers who are much better qualified than me, and so that you can actually develop the correct view instead of whatever incorrect views I happen to pass on to you. But if I pass them on, they're unintentional. I won't try and deceive you. That verse that I just read was that first outline, why you need to meditate on the correct view. Okay, so why do we need to meditate on it? Because we're unhappy, we're miserable, we're suffering. Good reason, isn't it? Okay, now you might say, well, how in the world is meditating on the emptiness of inherent existence going to make me happy? I don't even understand what it means. How is it going to make me happy? In fact, it makes me more confused. What are you talking about, emptiness of inherent existence? You know, there's only emptiness of my bank account. An emptiness of my refrigerator, but, you know, that's about it. So why do we need to meditate on the correct view? And to meditate on it, we have to understand it first. Why is that important? Well, to understand that, we have to understand the Four Noble Truths and why we're involved in cyclic existence to start with. And what is cyclic existence? So cyclic existence is having to take rebirth under the force of ignorance over and over and over and over and over again. Okay? So we are born again Buddhists, but in the other sense of the word. Okay, we are born again and again and again. Without choice. I mean, did you have choice? Did you ever wonder why you're born you? Did you choose to be born you? Did you choose to be born in your family? Did you choose for people to criticize you and insult you and put you down? Do you choose to get sick? Did you choose to have the body you have? You know? We think we're in control, right? You know? I mean, we didn't choose any of this, did we? It's like we just kind of woke up and here we are, and there's this body which gets old and sick and dies, and our mind, which is, you know, totally off in la-la land, you know, spaced out, you know, or angry, or, you know, full of desire, or who knows what's going through our mind. You know, did we choose any of this? No. That's the meaning of cyclic existence. Okay, we are born with a body and a mind under the influence of ignorance. Okay, so from ignorance comes attachment. From attachment comes anger. So what is this ignorance? Okay, now the ignorance is, you know, ignorance is not the kind of ignorance that makes you vote for the wrong person for president, okay? That's another form of ignorance, okay? And ignorance isn't the kind of ignorance that you don't know all the capital cities of, you know, all the states, yeah? But it's the kind of ignorance where we superimpose a level of existence on phenomena that they do not have, okay? So the level of existence that we're superimposing is called inherent existence, okay? That means that when we see things, we see them as if they exist out there objectively, with their own essence, with their own nature, completely independent of our own mind. And we even think of ourselves as that way, don't we? You know, when you say, I want this. We were talking in the retreat, don't tell me what to do. Okay, there feels like there's a real me, a real I there. I mean, that's a strong one, isn't it, for us Americans? Don't tell me what to do. Yeah. Strong I. So we think that there's a real I there, a real self. You know, when we look at things, we look at the clock, there's a real clock, you know, there's real chocolate, where's my chocolate? Yeah, there's a real Prince Charming somewhere. He just hasn't shown up, but, you know, he's out there somewhere. Oh, I'm sorry, he's in the back of the room. Where are you? Hi! Finally! He even sent me a Valentine. Now I'm going to be happy. Okay, so this is the view of inherent existence. You know, happiness exists out there inherently. Everything is out there. Everything has its own nature. You know, and so therefore, you know, there's this big I that's the center of the universe, and my job in life is to get everything that makes this self feel good and to destroy everything that makes the self feel bad. Very simple, isn't it? You know, I mean, this is what animals do too. You know, animals wag their tail at their friend and they bark at their enemy. And we human beings do the same. I mean, we don't, our tail looks different, but, you know, we're nice to the people who help us, we're rotten to the people who we don't like. And we think that, you know, the whole way to be happy is to rearrange the external world, because when we look at things, it feels like everything has its own nature, and the center of the whole thing is this solid me. Yeah. So this is the view of ignorance, because we assume that all these things exist in the way they appear. You know, they appear solid and real, and we take that for granted. We grasp them as existing in this way. We assent to that appearance, and we live our life like that, you know, from morning till night. And if you think about it,
No, don't you? Yeah. I mean, everything centers around this big me that we're so sure exists. And so, due to the attachment overestimating the good qualities of someone or something, then we do all these actions or karma. Yeah. And it's all motivated by selfishness, trying to get what we want. So it becomes negative action that then leads to, suffering results. When something gets in the way of our happiness, we attack it, don't we? Yeah, attack. And attack and destroy. Do as much as you can. And so motivated by anger and hatred and resentment and belligerence, then we create more negative actions, which that's called karma, which leads seeds, or traces of energy in our mind stream, which brings about more, more unsatisfactory and suffering results. And then, of course, whenever we're in unpleasant results, what do? We get attached to what we think externally will bring us happiness, and we attack more on what we think externally is causing our problem. So we're just cycling. Do you see how, through our own disturbing attitudes, we create actions that bring about, experiences, and those experiences become the setting in which more disturbing attitudes and negative emotions arise, and we do more actions that create more problematic experiences and in which more negative emotions arise. Okay, so it just goes on and on and on. And the whole root is that ignorance which misapprehends how things exist. So we misapprehend how phenomena exist, and we misapprehend how the self exists. And so this is the source of all of our confusion. So it's not your boss that's the cause of your problems. Okay? And it's not your landlord, and it's not your ex-husband. It's our own ignorance that's the source of our problems. So, what is the correct view? The correct view is the mind, the wisdom, that sees how things actually do exist. So, since the way ignorance apprehends things and the way wisdom apprehends things are exactly the opposite, they can't both exist manifestly in the mind at the same time. Okay? You can't have fire and water in the same place at one time. I mean, they counteract each other. So when the wisdom understands how things do exist, it overcomes the ignorance, because the ignorance is a misapprehension. It can be overcome. So the more we understand the correct view, and the more we habituate our mind to the correct view, so that we actually see it directly and begin to apprehend things with that view, with that wisdom, then very naturally the ignorance has to diminish to a point where it's totally eradicated. Once the ignorance is totally eradicated, once the ignorance is totally eradicated, the anger, attachment, jealousy, apprehension, fear, anxiety, all of that stuff can no longer arise, because that's all based on ignorance. When all those disturbing emotions no longer arise, then we no longer create the kind of actions that keep us revolved in this cycle of existence. Okay, so that's why understanding emptiness, the correct view, is so important, because it's the direct antidote to the very root of all of our problems. Okay. So that's why it's important. And if we want to get anywhere on the spiritual path, we talk about that sometimes there's five paths leading to Buddhahood, path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and no more learning. They're a progressive series of paths, and the demarcation lines, once you're on the path of accumulation, the demarcation lines between that and all the other paths are dependent upon your view of emptiness. And so it's by deepening that view and familiarizing our mind more and more with reality that we actually purify the mind and become either arhats or Buddhas. The Buddha, when he taught, gave, you know, many different views of emptiness. Yeah, because he taught different people at different times. And being a very skillful teacher, he was able to tune in to where people were at any specific time and teach according to their level of understanding. And so the way he explained emptiness differed sometimes from one sutra to the next. And that wasn't because the Buddha was lying. It wasn't because the Buddha was confused. It was, like I said, because he's very skillful. And so what later commentators did is, you know, again, according to their views, they adopted certain views that the Buddha took, and they took certain of the sutras, of the teachings that the Buddha gave, and said that they were definitive. In other words, they described the actual understanding of emptiness. And they said other teachings were interpretable. In other words, they didn't describe the Buddha's real intent, the deeper understanding of reality, but they had, you know, they were provisional according to that audience, and they needed to be interpreted in order to really understand what the Buddha was getting at. So different philosophical tenet schools arose. The Tibetans kind of made them into four different tenet schools. The Monday night class, I think, is going through some of them. And they all have slightly different views because they all say, you know, how they define the definitive teachings and the interpretable teachings are different. And one of the basic differences between these different philosophical views is what's said to be the negated object. Sometimes that's translated as the object to be refuted or the object to be negated. And what that means is the thing that we believe in that doesn't really exist. Okay? So the negated object is what our correct view is negating and saying that doesn't exist. Okay, so we have different levels of this negated object, and I'll just kind of give you a little sampling of them, and maybe you can think about if you have any of these. Okay, so the initial negated object is called sometimes it's translated as permanent, partless, and independent self. Another translation is unchanging, unitary, autonomous self. And what this means is a self or a person, an I, capital one, that it kind of like the Christian idea of soul or the Hindu idea of Atman. In other words, there's an essence. We all have an essence that is really us, that doesn't change. It's totally impermanent. It doesn't die. It doesn't get reborn. You know, it doesn't change. Yeah. Do you ever have that feeling that there's some soul inside of you, you know, and, you know, doesn't change at all. It's really you. And, you know, when you die, it just kind of goes somewhere else. It's like one package and it just picks up. And, you know, did you see that movie Ghosts? You know, somebody dies and you know, into another body. You know, there's something that's really me. Or there was another movie, what was it, about a dog? Somebody who was reborn as a dog and his friend was reborn as a chipmunk. They made some movie like this. What was it called? It started with an F. I can't remember it. Anyway, you know, but this idea as if it's the same person, whether it's in a human body or it was reborn as a chipmunk, because in the movie the little chipmunk was talking just like the person used to talk, okay, and so was the dog, you know, but something that's unchanging, yeah? Something that's unitary. In other words, it doesn't have parts. You know, it's totally unitary, one solid package. And the third quality of this one is that it's autonomous or independent. In other words, it doesn't depend on causes and conditions. And this is kind of the Christian view of the soul, isn't it? You know, it's permanent, it doesn't change, doesn't depend on causes and conditions. No matter what happens, you know, this is who you are, unchanging. Yeah, and we very often, many of us have this idea. We were brought up learning this idea. So this is the grossest negated object. Yeah, the grossest thing that we project on ourselves that is an incorrect view. You know, that there's some solid concrete soul that's really me. That view is very comforting, though, isn't it? Isn't it comforting? I mean, if you're afraid of death, to think, oh, but there's one thing, there's a soul that's me that doesn't die. You know, I just, you know, transport out of this body and go to heaven or, you know, do something else. It's very comforting. And but the problem is that it doesn't exist. Okay, so that's why it's called a negated object, and the concept that grasps it is called, you know, a misconception. You know, it's a false concept. And I mean, we have tons of false concepts. This isn't our only one. We have, you know, we're chock-a-block full of them. Okay, but this is one of the grossest ones, because the thing is, if you search to try and find such a permanent, heartless, you know, autonomous self or soul, it's very difficult to find it. In fact, I dare say it's impossible. We can believe in it. The idea of believing in the existence of a soul or a self with a capital S, that idea exists. But that soul or that self doesn't exist. Okay? So you have the negated object, and then you have the conception or the grasping at that negated object. A little bit more subtle than that, the next level of negated object is called self-sufficient, substantially existent self. Okay, got that one? So I abbreviated SSSE. this is my note-taking. Self-sufficient, substantially existent self or person. So there's two kind of ways that it gets described, and just check your own feeling of self and see if you have either of these. One is that the relationship between the self or the person on one hand and the body and mind, also called the aggregates, okay? The relationship between the self and the body and mind. One analogy is that the body and mind, or the aggregates, are like sheep, and the self is the shepherd. Okay? So, you know, you have a body and mind, and the eye takes charge and guides the body and mind. Do you ever have that feeling about yourself? You know, like there's an eye that's somehow there, you know, it's kind of a little bit, you're not quite sure where it is, but it's the one that tells the body and mind what to do. Body walk, mind think, you know. Yeah? Do you ever have that? Okay? Or sometimes another analogy that's slightly different to show the relationship between the aggregates and the self is that the aggregates are like salespeople and the self is the head salesperson. Okay, so here, they're all, you know, the head, the chief, is still a salesperson. Okay, but they're somehow more important. Right? So it's here, the feeling is more kind of like, you know, you have the body and mind, and, you know, among the aggregates, One part is the mental consciousness, you know, your mental consciousness that thinks and, you know, perceives things mentally. And that one's kind of, we see that one as like the head salesperson, you know, and then our mental consciousness, that's me. And that bosses around all the aggregates, you know? Okay? But there's this feeling of there's a me, and it's not totally separate from the aggregates. Yeah, it's kind of in there somewhere, but it's more important. So the mental consciousness is the self, and it's more important than all the other parts that make us up. And it kind of is the boss. I think I have little analogies that come to mind. Do you remember, I don't know when it was, in European philosophical history, they had this idea of the, what was it, humunculus? Like there was this little person in your pituitary gland? You know, do you remember, some of you who are philosophy students probably know and can explain better than I, but it was a view that was quite prominent in the West, you know. Yourself, the person, was this little homunculus in your pituitary gland, and that kind of ran the show. Yeah. Or another example I think of is the Wizard of Oz. Yeah. And you have the wizard and, you know, his big ego trip. And then, you know, Toto pulls the curtain behind and you have the person behind pulling the switches. So that's kind of, you know, like there's somebody in there. You know, this is the feeling of like the self-sufficient substantial existence. There's someone in there who's kind of running the show. Yeah. Do you have that feeling sometimes? Like there's a real I that's running the show. And sometimes we feel like it's, you know, part of the aggregates, part of the mind, body and mind, and it's just in charge. Or it's more like the shepherd kind of, you know, shooing the body and mind along, getting them going. Yeah. But we have that feeling, don't we? Yeah. And it feels like there's a real I. You know, there's a real me. Yeah? There's this little homunculus in there. There's this guy behind the big wizard thing pulling the knobs, making it all happen. Okay? So that's another level of misconception. Okay? A further level of misconception is, grasping at... Well, we won't go through all the different levels of misconception. There's a lot of them. But the essential one here is where the negated object is an inherently existent self, okay? Or sometimes it's called truly existent self from the level of the Prasangika tenet system, which is said to be the highest. That's the consequence, the middle way consequence school. That's said to be the highest view. And here, an inherently existent self is one that is mixed in with the body and mind, but also has its own nature. Okay? So it doesn't appear separate from the body and mind, but it's somehow independent and the boss of the show. Okay? And do you ever have that kind of feeling? You know, like we feel like there's an I in here, don't we? You know? So people say, where are you? I'm here. Or I'm here. We feel like there's an I, there's a self somewhere in this body. Don't you? Yeah? You know, like there's a real person somewhere in this body. It's not separate from the body and mind. It's not totally unified with the body and mind, but there's a real I. As in, don't tell me what to do. Okay? I mean, when you say that, can you get that feeling, generate in your mind that feeling a little bit of, don't tell me what to do. You know? I mean, you know how you feel when you feel that? How does the I that doesn't want to be told what to do, how does that I appear to exist? Okay. It seems very real, doesn't it? Yeah. It's incredibly real. It seems to, exist under its own power. You know, it's really there. It doesn't seem to depend on anything. don't tell me what to do. It seems like, I mean, that I doesn't seem to depend on the body, doesn't seem to depend on the mind, doesn't seem, you know, it's just under its own power. It's the Lord ruler of the universe, you know, so don't tell Lord ruler of the universe what to do. I mean, that's how dumb everybody is. They tell me what to do. Don't they know better? Yeah, I'm in charge here, and I know what's best. Yeah. So when we have that feeling of I, that's the grasping at the inherently existent I. And that I that we grasp at is the negated object, the inherently existent one, okay? So that example of don't tell me what to do is one example of, you know, how the I appears. Another example, another one we have all the time, is poor me, okay? So when you're into your poor me trip, yeah, which we're very professional at doing, yeah, poor me, I'm the worst one. Nobody loves me. Nobody appreciates me. You know, I'm always left out. They don't invite me to the party. Everybody else gets the good things. I'm the inferior one. They don't respect me. Okay, poor me. Huh? Got that one? Hmm? Okay, how does the self, the I, appear to exist when you get into poor me? It's quite solid, doesn't it? Yeah? I mean, there feels like there's a real person that definitely is worthy of the pity of the entire universe. Don't you feel that way? I'm not the only one. Come on. Yeah? You know, when we get into that big thing, oh, poor me, and I'm so stupid, and I can't do anything right. My brother and sister always get more attention, and they're more successful, and I'm a failure, and, you know. Okay, so poor me, that how the I appears to exist when we get into poor me, that is the negated object. Now, you're probably sitting there thinking, what in the world is this lady talking about? Poor me exists. Excuse me, don't tell me that's the negated object. Don't tell me that I'm hallucinating when I think poor me, or when I tell you to get off my back and don't tell me what to do, because I exist, you know. Right? Don't we have that feeling? Yeah? So we not only have this misconception, but on top of that, we think it's true. Yeah. And then, yeah, we don't even realize that the level of misconception and misapprehension we have. I mean, that's why you can see we have so many problems, you know, and so much confusion in our life. We have no idea how ignorant we are.